IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello everyone, I'm Pranay and it's been a really long time since I have been on All Things Policy. So it's good to be back. And the backdrop for today's conversation is the first in-person Quad Summit that took place late last month. And now what I found out is that, you know, the Quad was an ad hoc formation until 2 or 3 years ago. And not unsurprisingly, the research on it was also quite ad hoc, to say less charitably. So I was quite delighted to read a systematic assessment of the Quad, and it was the only such systematic assessment that I have come across until now. It is called Roadmap to Quad Success, Practical Recommendations for Action and Sustainability. So to tell us more about what these practical recommendations are, I have with us the author of that report, Haley Channa. Haley is a senior policy fellow at the Perth US Asia Center, and she is joining us from Canberra in Australia. So welcome, Haley, to All Things Policy.
Thank you so much, Pranay. I'm delighted to be on All Things Policy and to talk about the Quad, which I find very exciting.
Yeah, so let's dive right in. Haley, before we go into the recent Quad summit, I wanted to ask you, what is the geopolitical significance of the Quad for Australia, in your view? Because we've heard about US and we keep debating this endlessly about India and what is the significance of it. But we know less about the Australian perspective. So could you talk us about that?
Thanks, Pranay. Yeah, that's a great question because, as you know, the Quad has had an on-again, off-again history since all the way back since 2004. So there is a bigger picture here about why now and why Australia is interested. And I think generally all four Quad countries acknowledge that the region that we live in, the Indo-Pacific region, is in a much more tense position than it has been in previous decades. And while in the past, Asia has been very keen to do bilateral relations, particularly bilateral security relations, I think we are finally seeing a movement towards more what I call minilateralism and other people call multilateralism, being small groupings of like-minded countries coming together. So that is actually how the Quad initially started. Is back in 2004, there was the Indian Ocean tsunami, which caused total devastation across the Indo-Pacific region, particularly in Indonesia, but also in Sri Lanka. And at that time, there were the four countries of the Quad, Australia, Japan, the US, and India, that recognized an immediate challenge and also immediate ways that they could assist, including through sending their naval vessels and also their humanitarian disaster relief personnel to different parts of the region to respond to this tragedy. And so from those initial beginnings, I think Japan in particular under Shinzo Abe saw an opportunity for these four countries, four democracies that were significant countries in the region, to do more work together. And so a strategic dialogue was started that was originally called the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. More recently now, though, we see a more challenging regional situation. So the Quad has really evolved from something that looked at a humanitarian and environmental crisis to looking at more strategic challenges. And I think that is also where the story of China comes in terms of, you know, in the sort of 20-teens, it becoming more aggressive in its territorial ambitions in the South China Sea and also in its territorial clashes with India on your shared border. And then in the backdrop, we also had China being more assertive in terms of cyber attacks and even within its own borders, cracking down on minority groups like the Uyghurs. So we see this sort of regional dynamics shifting to a more hostile, more tense environment, and countries like Australia, Japan, India, and the United States looking for new ways to build groups of countries to tackle certain issues. So I think what we can see is really insecurity more from our countries and them wanting to lead the way in new ways of working together that aren't the traditional bilateral relations that we keep seeing.
Right, right. So that's really interesting. So let's talk about the Australian angle further. Now, as you write in your report as well, that Australia withdrew from the Quad military exercises in 2008, right? But this time around, it's Australia which is taking a lead on a lot of Quad initiatives, whether it is the Quad technology network or many others, right? And Australia's diplomacy has been in overdrive on so many other fronts as well, right? So what explains this change, according to you, regarding the Quad?
Yeah, this is a great question. And there's so many different angles I want to attack it from. So before I started with my position at the Perth US Asia Centre, I worked for the Australian Department of Defence in an area called International Policy Division. And I started there back in 2016. And at the time, I was actually on a desk that looked after a lot of different relationships. It had Europe. It also looked after the UN, peacekeeping, and a few other partnerships. And what I recognized back in 2016 working for defense was there was a broadness to our defense cooperation engagement internationally, but not a depth of cooperation with key partners in the Indo-Pacific. So I think back then, and you know, with large bureaucratic organizations, they can be very slow to move to changes. So the Australian Department of Defense, it has a civilian workforce of 30,000 people. Makes it our largest government department. So even when there were strategic shifts in our immediate region that required us to reprioritize our resources, including, you know, our military activities, but also our dialogues, more to focus on our immediate neighborhood, I think the department was quite slow to move into that. But now I think after the delivery of the Defense Strategic Update in 2020, we are where we need to be in terms of a much more of a focus on countries in our immediate region. And part of that is the Quad. We are reinvesting in partnerships that are closer to us. And I suppose you could have a counter argument that AUKUS, the Australia, US, UK submarine and technology sharing deal, shows that we are still looking outside the region, which is true. We are not blinkered, but there's definitely been retraction to the region so that we're focused more on our immediate relationships. And you can see that in our strategic documents. So some of our priority countries other than the US are Japan, India, and Indonesia. And I also argue that South Korea has a place in that as well. And so we see things like not only the Quad grouping, but also things like the Australia, France, India trilateral meeting that's held at the ministerial level. And finally, I think we are moving towards a region which, unlike Europe, which has NATO, we don't have the equivalent kind of frameworks in place. And I don't think that pure alliance relationships with the United States are going to be fit for purpose in terms of be everything that Australia needs going forward. So we need to have partnerships with countries that aren't necessarily US treaty allies. We need to have much deeper relations with countries like India and South Korea.
Right. So, you know, Edward Luttwak's book, China's Rise and the Logic of Strategy, in that he mentioned an interesting point that, you know, when there's a common adversary, the size of China, it becomes easier for countries and other countries to put aside their mutual differences and come together. You know, that's the logic of strategy, even though they have differences. But this common adversary just melts away some of those differences, you know. So how much of that has played into Australia's perspective as well? Because we know from here that, for example, the political interference issues that were raised a couple of years ago, and then now the trade restrictions that China has put, they have sort of, what role have they played in Australia's strategic thinking?
Oh, massive role for sure. I think Australia also hasn't had the most perfect track record in how it has responded to China. But if I was to rate it, I would say it is doing pretty well. It's definitely muddling through. So for instance, things like being out in front and banning the Chinese telecommunications company Huawei Australia was one of the first countries to take that kind of action, and then other countries like the United States followed suit. And Australia's also been outspoken on a number of issues to do with China. So I think where Australia has done well is, like you mentioned too, the sort of trade tariffs and coercive trade practices that China has inflicted on Australia haven't worked in the way that China imagined that they would have. And instead of Australia buckling under the economic pressure of it, we've found other international markets to sell a number of our commodities, like wine, for instance. So I would rate Australia as having done well in some areas. Where it hasn't done so well, I think, is in actually communicating with China directly. Australian politicians and the Australian government has been very outspoken, whereas some other countries in the region have decided to approach China in a different way in terms of doing things more privately and not as publicly. For instance, you know, Australia's also back in July this year called out China directly for its cyber attacks. So we've done a lot of things and been out in front in a number of ways. How that's going to affect the long-term relationship, I'm quite concerned about, because if there was anything I was going to tweak in the way that Australia is responding to China, it would be diplomatically how we talk about China, because definitely we need to talk to our Australian business community so that it is fully knowledgeable and understanding of the challenges and risks that China as a country presents. But in terms of diplomacy, I think there are other ways we can speak in back channels to China to try and get the relationship back on track, because we definitely need some off-ramps to continued heightened tensions with China, because at the moment it just seems to be continually escalating. And I know that's also something that India is facing, is that there's not a lot of diplomatic off-ramps with China, which is what we really need to do. The alternative is really a horrible future where we're just continually in a conflict with China in a number of different areas. And I don't think that serves anyone's benefit, least of all China.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I guess China and under Xi Jinping has probably agreed to follow that path. So I don't know how much room for maneuver is there amongst the other countries. Although I feel the important point that you mentioned on the business front, and I guess what we are talking here is that the size of the demand function that China provides, that is sort of unrivaled for many countries, including, say, India, Australia, etc. So I guess that's where India's role comes in, because, again, it's a big player in terms of the demand that it can provide to other businesses. And over the last few years, sitting here in Bangalore, far away from Delhi, I've been very fascinated by Australia's outreach to places beyond Delhi. And I've been looking at whether it's the paradiplomacy front or the Australia's India Economic Strategy 2035 report, or the new ambassadorships which Australia has created on gender equality or critical technologies and cyber affairs, is really fascinating to see. So where does India fit in all this in Australia's imagination?
Well, India looms large, as it does for the entire region. What's been very interesting to see with our relationship with India is it's different from a lot of Australia's other foreign relations, in the sense that our other relations with Japan or other countries in the region started from a blossoming trade relationship. And as trade grew, then our security links naturally grew as well. But with India, we see the reverse of that, where we've been more interested in having these closer security links, and now we're following up with the economic links. So our former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, I know is a special envoy to India in charge of improving trade between our two countries. And so I think if you are judging the relationship, the bilateral relationship, where it really needs to improve is on that economic trade side, so that we have a more trading relationship to match and complement some of the other aspects of our relations, whether that's the security side or even Indian students coming to Australia, the people-to-people links, which are so close. So I would really like to see, and I'm glad to see, the Australian government putting resources behind improving the trade relationship, because we do, like you said before, we can't have the risk of having one major trading partner in China. We need to diversify our trade, find other trading partners, in the same way that we also need to diversify where our international students come from. You know, I think the international student numbers that we have come to Australia are either our second or third largest commodity for the country. And so we can't always be relying, especially in a COVID world, having international students coming and propping up our economy that way. We need to be diversifying in a lot of different areas. But India is a very important country for Australia. We have had a rocky past in terms of all the way back looking at Australia's pointing out to India things about its nuclear program, for instance, and Australia's non-nuclear status. And there have been things like really regrettable attacks on Indian students and Indian workers in Australia. But I hope we are moving on from all of that trouble and looking at a bright new future where we have so many more common interests and the relationship can grow in new ways that are just waiting to be capitalized on.
Right. That's really interesting and good to know the developments that have taken place in recent years. Now let's come to the report, right? So your report is titled Roadmap to Quad Success, Practical Recommendations for Action and Sustainability, right? So were the recommendations earlier impractical in the Quad? What was your motivation for picking this topic?
Well, actually, the way I came up with that title was because a lot of reports that I see are always, or opinion pieces or blogs, they provide someone's opinion, but they don't actually give a practical method for actual policymakers to follow up on. And because I have this background making policy, I wanted to help the other people that I knew I'd left behind, my former colleagues, to actually provide things that they could follow up on that wasn't just my opinion about particularly this discussion around the Quad, whether or not it will fall to pieces or whether it's going to continue or whether or not it's targeted directly at China. I was kind of sick of that debate, which I felt had happened too much. And I hadn't heard a lot of people providing solutions to the challenges that they posed. So that was the reason in calling it, you know, practical solutions. And I decided to look at all of the different areas that the Quad had previously flagged an interest in cooperation, because I didn't want to reinvent the wheel necessarily. There's already a lot of areas where the Quad nations have said that they will cooperate. And so I didn't want to start adding more suggestions to the pile. I wanted to condense and narrow down, really focus in on what it was that the Quad was prioritizing. Because I think that had been part of the problem of the Quad framework in the past, in the sense that people were always wondering what the Quad is and what it's meant to do. And if it is going to be some sort of a naval or military coalition against China, did that mean that Naval Exercise Malabar was going to be the flagship Quad activity or not? So I did. I took all of the different recommendations and decided to narrow them down.
Right. Yeah. And your policy background shines through in the report. The recommendations are all practical that countries can directly consider. Now, let me come to a provocative question, right? So if China is the force that is bringing this Quad together, that's how we understand it. No report will mention this, no official document will mention this. So if that is the case, why not that this relationship be focused on everything related to resisting China's overreach? And why even go into so many areas, which in your report you've already tried to consolidate them into manageable chunks, right? So why shouldn't we do the former and leave all other issues aside? Why do you?
Yeah, this is a great question, especially because it was one of the criticisms too that I heard from Southeast Asian nations, is that they just wanted the Quad to come out and say and be honest about what it was really doing and the fact that it was really targeted against China. The point that you pick up on about the Quad coming together because of China is a true point. If China wasn't as assertive or as aggressive in some of its territorial and other ambitions, the Quad would not have the same motivation and momentum that it currently does now. I mean, we just saw two leaders-level meetings in the span of 6 months, which, first of all, had never happened before for the Quad, and now two in less than a year is extreme. So the reason why the Quad shouldn't be primarily targeted at China is because you can never, first of all, it would be unsuccessful, I believe, if the Quad was going to say that it was primarily responding to China and trying to counter Chinese aggression and maintain US-dominated regional order. I just don't think the Quad would be successful. And to be honest, that makes it the discussion very black and white that, you know, this is to counter this. When in reality, that's not actually what the countries want to do. Obviously, they want China to resolve its disputes peacefully and in accordance with international law in everything that it does, and to not do some of the really hostile activities that it is doing. But you don't approach a problem head on in this case. In this case, I think the Quad is going to be far more successful as an attraction mechanism rather than its own counter, you know, military counterweight. So I do really like the analogy of you attract, you know, flies with honey rather than with vinegar. And so the idea is that the Quad countries need to be better than China. If they're going to, and this comes down to as well, what you believe the key purpose of the Quad is. And my view of the Quad is that it wants the same regional order that was here before China started all of its hostile actions. But more than that, it wants a stable region that doesn't have pandemics or cyber attacks or terrorism or climate change. It wants to have a stable, prosperous region that will benefit everyone. But in order to have that kind of a region, you don't win those wars through military action. You don't win the climate change battle by fighting China. And so I think it's really a mistake to say that the Quad is all about China, even though the momentum for it is definitely because of Chinese aggression. There are so many other challenges that the Quad nations have rightly identified that they could attack together rather than as separate entities. I mean, you can't do anything about counterterrorism without working with other countries in the region. I mean, Australia has learned that we work extremely closely with Indonesia. We also work with the Philippines and other countries in Southeast Asia. And so, yeah, as we see these challenges happening and getting more entrenched and more difficult over years, we are now moving to this model of working in minilateral frameworks where we can have more leverage. So, for example, the COVID-19 pandemic, it was a like stroke of genius that the Quad decided to work on that COVID pandemic, because the four Quad nations had something unique to bring to that cooperation. So, for example, the United States with its major pharmaceutical companies and resources was going to fund the collaboration. Japan also was going to bring to bear some Japanese loans. India is going to actually manufacture the vaccines, and then Australia is going to distribute them to the region. So each of the four countries were given a task where they could have a part of, in this case, what is a supply chain to deliver vaccines to the region. Now, if it can replicate that kind of activity with some of its other areas of cooperation, that's going to make the sum of the whole more than the sum of its parts, individual parts.
Yeah, really nice answer. Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of points and see what your reactions are to this. Like you really nicely mentioned about the pitfalls of making this and projecting it as an anti-China cooperation is one that it becomes very easy for the adversary to puncture such a thing, right? So they can just do one activity and which will just show that, hey, you were together, but look, you couldn't stop me. So it is really sets yourself up for failures. And the second point that you mentioned about partners is so important, right? Because currently we see a lot of this debate on debt trap diplomacy, etc., in the neighborhood. But a lot of it is because China is an alternative option for a lot of countries. So to sort of overtake China, we need to provide a better alternative. And that is where I guess coming together on many of these fronts might help. Don't you think so?
Yeah, exactly. It simplifies the situation way too much by saying that the Quad is an anti-China mechanism. And China has been saying that and getting some currency actually from countries in that kind of argument. And so, yeah, that's why I think it was so important that the Quad and the latest Quad summit came out not just with vaccines, but climate change and critical technology, because these are things that other countries in the region can get on board with and get behind. Because it's not just Australia that's reliant on China for its trade. You know, a lot of Southeast Asian nations have China as their primary trading partner. Otherwise, they actually have China as their immediate neighbour with a land border. So, yeah, they need to have other more attractive options and have, you know, instead of countries with having some sort of battle to the bottom, having it elevated so that the alternative is so attractive that countries have no option but to get behind it. And I think that's why the Quad chose such a positive agenda in terms of vaccines and climate change and critical tech. It also makes it very difficult for China to criticize countries doing good things for the region.
Right, absolutely. So now let's come to the framework that's there in your report. And it was a really novel framework, which I found, where you tried to evaluate which of the 10 working group areas of the Quad need prioritization. So first of all, I was so surprised that there are 10 working groups. I was under the impression that there were just 3 which were announced in the first summit level meeting. So 10 is a lot. So first of all, how do you think of prioritization, and tell us more about your framework?
Yeah. So when I first thought about writing this paper, I had trouble thinking, well, what am I going to say? You know, because a lot of the people that provide analysis on the Quad, they go from their own biases. You know, what personally do they like the most? What is their area of expertise? You know, how do they judge what they think is the most important thing? And depending on who you ask, if you ask someone from a defense background or a trade background or a foreign policy background or a technology background, you'll get 5 totally different answers. So I looked into what the Quad had actually agreed, because at the first leaders summit back in March, they announced these 3 working groups: vaccines, climate change, and critical technology. But before that leaders level meeting, they had had a number of meetings at the foreign minister or foreign secretary level. And those meetings happened at the end of 2020 and then again in early 2021. And there were a number of working groups that were established out of those meetings. And when I saw the number, I felt really sorry for my old colleagues who I worked with, because I know that the amount of human resourcing and time that's required to just to staff a working group is very difficult. It's very time consuming. And this is on top of your normal workload, because the other meetings that we have don't go away. It's funny, you know, when I was working for the Department of Defense back in the 20-teens, I actually had responsibility for the Quad for a year or so, but I didn't do any work on the Quad because nothing was happening on the Quad. Now that the Quad is really revitalized and going forward at a pace of knots, there's going to be so much work required to staff these groups. And it also reminded me of the fact that every time there's a major meeting of world leaders or foreign ministers or defense ministers, especially for annual meetings, there is a big pressure on public servants to come up with new recommendations at the end of each meeting for the media conference. Otherwise, it appears as though the meeting wasn't a success. You know, if you didn't announce a number of new cooperative practices or projects, the media asks, well, why did you bother meeting? When in reality, sometimes a face-to-face meeting with a counterpart is all about relationship building and trust building and building these habits of cooperation. But then there's this pressure to always announce something means that you're going to have increasingly long list of things to do. And I feel like that might be what has happened with the Quad meetings, because yeah, after the March meeting, there were 10 things. After the in-person leaders summit that happened in Washington, D.C., there's now 12. So when you look at these things, you think about your own to-do list at home. Yeah, you wonder what is the most important thing to do first. Obviously, of all of the things, the most immediate thing was the COVID vaccine. And this also harks back to the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami, where there was an immediate threat that affected all 4 countries and the broader region. So I feel like the cooperation that was able to happen under the COVID vaccine provides a model for the Quad countries to take forward to apply to their other areas. So what I did with this really complicated table is actually apply the same rules that fit why COVID vaccine was a good area to cooperate on to the other areas. So, for example, the reason the COVID vaccine cooperation is so good is because all of the four countries have very strong political convergence for action. As I said before, all four nations are bringing something unique to the collaboration, which justifies why it should happen under the Quad and not something else. There's a shared sense of regional urgency, a tangible benefit for countries in the region. And this other thing that was really important, another aspect of the cooperation, was that it's not going to antagonize China in the same way that more maritime cooperation might antagonize China. So I laid that framework over the other areas of cooperation, and the ones that I found had the best chance of mimicking the success of the COVID announcements were quality infrastructure, critical and emerging technology, and supply chain resilience. So then I went about actually narrowing down even further to look at, okay, I don't want to just tell government officials what of the areas they should look at, because I want to tell them specifically what in those areas they should do. Because if you do try and do all things at once, you're going to progress things really, really slowly. People aren't going to be able to notice that you're actually doing anything. And so the COVID-19 vaccine commitment, you can physically see vaccines going into arms. You know how many vaccines the Quad's given to the region. So you need something tangible to show people that cooperation is actually happening. So for quality infrastructure, I suggested that the one project the Quad countries should look at was undersea fiber optic communications cables. Now, this is going to get into sort of some technical jargon, but basically, if you don't have a telephone or internet, then you can't have a developed economy. And so getting, internet and communications cables that are reliable to Pacific Island countries in particular, and also, Southeast Asia, which is doing a lot better than the Pacific, but still needs more reliable and wider broadband, that's really important. And Pranya, something that you've looked at in the critical technologies area is semiconductors. So I used a lot of Takshashila Institute work in terms of looking at semiconductor cooperation between the Quad countries. The reason they should focus on that as their critical technology cooperation is semiconductors are ubiquitous. They're used in everything from computers to telephones to cars to refrigerators. And the semiconductor supply chain has a bit of a choke point in the sense that only a handful of countries in the world actually produce them. So semiconductors was what I looked at for critical technology. And then on supply chains, I also looked at improving the supply chain for large capacity batteries, because batteries, again, like semiconductors, go into a lot of electronic goods, and the supply chain for that is quite strained at the moment. So from all of these things, the now 12 priorities of the Quad, I narrowed it down to 3 and then gave some specific examples. And I really hope that would be helpful to the Quad countries, because just getting together four nations of which, yes, they're like-minded, they have similar values, but they are such different countries in so many ways, developmentally, culturally, politically, historically. They're all going to have different priorities. So you need some kind of metrics to narrow it down that doesn't allow the individual priorities of the nations themselves or domestic departments within them to poison the well. So I hope that this is something, these ideas that the Quad countries will take forward. And I note that at the Leaders Summit that happened in Washington, D.C., they did announce that semiconductors was a focus. They also announced infrastructure, although they didn't expand on what kinds of infrastructure. And they did a number of other things too. So I was pretty pleased with the summit that happened.
Right. Yeah, no, you formulated this brilliantly. My argument on semiconductors was limited to that point of the fact that Quad as a group has complementary strengths that they can bring to the table. But you've expanded it to so many other dimensions. And I think it fits into all the criteria that you mentioned, right? It can't be seen as being antagonistic to one particular adversary. It provides benefits to all countries because everyone is reliant on the semiconductor supply chain. Yeah, and it is something where the four countries can can actually do something substantial. What I also like, and this is a pet peeve of mine, that a lot of foreign policy discussions actually fall into the trap of opportunity cost neglect, right? So everyone says India should do everything, right? I mean, they should do things in the Indian Ocean, West Asia. I'm sure it must be happening in Australia as well. But the idea is that we don't think of the capacity required for any initiative. And like you really nicely mentioned, that each of these initiatives require people, require thinking, require a lot of efforts which are over and above what they are doing currently. It means that we need to prioritize, we need to understand trade-offs. And that's what your report does, and which wasn't there in any of the other discussions that I have seen until now. So thanks for that. And now let me talk about the last question. So you briefly mentioned this, but in the backdrop of your report, how would you rate the first in-person summit meeting? And what is the future roadmap that you would propose?
So amidst all of the criticism that some people can have of these major meetings, that, you know, the sort of summitry that happens, I was really pleasantly surprised by the outcomes of the first in-person meeting. I think it achieved a number of things. It definitely served to help better brand the Quad framework, which has suffered from this issue of explaining exactly what it is and what it's going to do. So one of the ways that this summit improved that was immediately after the summit, the Quad nations actually launched their own website. So there's a website which shows how they are delivering their COVID-19 vaccine pledge. And it provides information not only on that pledge, it also provides information on the Quad initiative itself. And it includes things like a link to the Quad principles and their values. And so it really serves to better brand the framework as this positive initiative for providing regional public goods. And I liked the announcements because they weren't just a restating of national positions. They also said, you know, these are the actions that we're going to take next. And they did dive down more deeply into some of the areas that had been discussed earlier in the year. So I really liked that. The other thing that they announced was a senior cyber working group where people who are cyber experts are going to meet regularly to discuss how they can work in this area. Because something that's not often mentioned or emphasized very regularly is that technology cooperation can be quite difficult because of security concerns among sharing different technology and defense secrets. So I really liked that they said what other initiatives they had and the commitment. It showed the commitment, I think. So there was more detail. I really liked that. And I think that they have all of the elements that they need in place to make it a very successful framework. But the main thing that they need to do is deliver on their commitments. So, for example, the vaccine pledge, they're due to give 1 billion vaccines to the Indo-Pacific by the end of 2022. And the website that they've launched gives you a counter to show, it shows how many vaccines have been delivered and the amount of money that's been committed as well. So that is you being able to see the Quad delivering on its promise in real time. I think they need something broader, like an overall Quad website that will keep track of all of their different commitments. It could also include things like a record of their previous joint statements and op-eds, and it could help provide a platform for different interest groups and the private sector to actually get in touch and work with the Quad on particular initiatives. So I see that being particularly effective in the infrastructure space, but also in terms of the cyber security space. You know, businesses might want to work with the Quad nations on something in particular. So I rated it quite highly. It's just a matter of putting their money where their mouth is now and actually delivering, because the worst thing that we could possibly see is they're making these announcements and then not following up with concrete action. So one of the ones that brings to mind is on climate change, for instance. I was really worried that because of Australia's position on climate change, which is very conservative because our government is a coalition which includes our Nationals Party, and they have not been very forward-leaning in terms of adopting new clean energy or climate change adaptation because they speak for farmers and people that live in rural areas. So I was worried Australia might hold back the Quad in terms of the climate change commitment. And I know President Biden was very strongly pushing for the Quad to do something on climate change. They did announce a number of actual activities. For instance, they're going to invest in green hydrogen technology, and they're also going to improve the practices around four major ports, so one port in each of the four nations. And so I liked that it had more detail, because I think that's what government announcements are lacking, is scratch the surface and there's no detail to what they're saying. And so that gives them too much latitude to not deliver on anything. So I was really pleased to see more detail, and I hope that we see them reporting on their successes in future through things like a website and other public statements that can allow countries to follow along with the Quad's success, because half the battle here is the PR battle. If the Quad can actually show that it's not just a talk shop, it's actually giving regional goods out, then it's going to get a lot more support in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And criticisms from China will be more difficult for China to make, because the Quad will be producing actual outcomes and not just be a dialogue.
Indeed. So one last question, and I want to put you in a spot. So in the spirit of confronting trade-offs, if someone were to put a gun to your head and tell, Haley, drop at least two things from the 12 working groups, which were the ones will you drop?
Oh my God, what a great question. I wish I could still actually have some power within the Australian government agencies and be able to cut some of the fat off of the Quad, different Quad cooperation areas. You know, I think one of the areas I'd cut straight away would be countering disinformation. The reason I say that one is because, well, first of all, you need to hear, I guess, what all of the areas are so that you know what I'm cutting, because that might actually sound like something good. So all the areas are vaccines, climate change, quality infrastructure, humanitarian and disaster response, critical and emerging technology, cyber, supply chain resilience, maritime security, counterterrorism, countering disinformation. And then since the most recent meeting, there's also space and education.
Yeah. And biotech also was mentioned. So I don't know what happened.
Good point. That's exactly right. I think I might have amalgamated biotech into the vaccine delivery, because they also want to do World Health Organization reforms. And to be honest, I just wanted to give them a little, you know, win by putting a couple of them into the COVID vaccine one.
Yeah.
So yeah, cutting two is pretty easy, I think, because there's 12. So I would cut countering disinformation from that list, because I just think it's too difficult right now. I think that we are still figuring out from a domestic standpoint, each of the four countries, if we're talking about, you know, fake news, or is it disinformation from external actors or internal actors? And then you have the problem too of domestic agencies not agreeing on what countering disinformation means. So I would cut that, just in the sense that they're going to find it hard to cooperate on that and to actually design a Quad activity that's going to be basically like, there's no low-hanging fruit in the countering disinformation area. The other area I would probably cut, I think honestly, would be space, which was one of the new ones. I really don't like it, because even though all the four countries have space agencies and space is a very aspirational topic to discuss, again, I think, first of all, they had enough to begin with, and I just see them having so many more things to gain from the cooperation than some of the other areas. Like, if you were to swap the question around a bit and say, in addition to what I've mentioned, what else do I like? I really like the counterterrorism one. I think that's really important. The counterterrorism one, especially post, I don't want to call it the fall of Afghanistan, but since the United States has left Afghanistan, there is a lot more of a risk of terrorism, particularly, you know, close to India, one of the Quad nations. And I would love to see them work more on that one, much more than I would like to see them work on space.
Right. Yeah. I mean, confronting trade-offs is always difficult. Yeah. Some of my colleagues have done work on the space bit, and it all sounds promising. But yes, we have to narrow down efforts and look at what is possible. And what I really like is One, the group is small enough to do things quickly, at least potentially, and it shouldn't fall into that trap of adding too many things, too many fraught issues over which they themselves don't have an alignment. How will they do anything for the other countries, right? I mean, I see this happening all the time between US and EU, for example. There are so many constituencies to align that action on something concrete always takes time. So better to keep it narrow and prioritize, as you said. So thanks.
That's exactly right. I mean, what benefit is there to the region on their space cooperation? Nothing.
I would say a lot of things. For example, satellite imagery, sharing weather information, sharing a lot of information related to, you know, remote sensing for farming, etc. There are, I think, a lot of those benefits which are there for the countries which don't have an active space program. So I can think of a lot of things which will concretely.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Particularly because space does feed into the climate change issue. So you could track certain things and give countries in the Pacific or Southeast Asia more information. That's a very good point. I always think of space in the sense of the military uses of space and not some of the other benefits. So you are definitely right. Why don't we put space into the climate change box? And then I get behind it.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you so much, Hayley, for this engaging conversation. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will too. And we'll link this report in the description of the show. Please do read it and let us know what you think. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach Podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.